Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Kidney Compass, where we talk about the latest developments in clinical trials that are shaping the field of nephrology. My name is Brendan Nguyen. I'm a nephrologist and clinical trialist at the George Institute for Global Health and Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, and I'm joined by my good friend and co-host, Associate Professor Shikha Wadhwani from Texas. Shikha, great to see you again.
Good to see you, Brendan. I'm very jealous about all the recent fun you've had without me, but I'm glad that we're getting to do this podcast again.
Well, it's been a fantastic week in Maui, Hawaii, an incredible week of great science, but also many cocktails, champagne, and time in the water and by the pool.
Rubbing it
And
in, per usual.
that's right. And so it was a really fantastic meeting, and looking forward to many others joining us next year in Maui. But we've got something really special today. We're joined by Professor Dana Rizik from the University of Alabama, Birmingham, who presented late-breaking results in Maui, Hawaii. And these late-breaking results were from the visionary trial of sibeprenlimab in IgA nephropathy, specifically the long-term GFR data and safety data. Welcome, Dana, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Brendan. It's a pleasure to join you today and to see you again after a quick trip to Maui.
Yes. Shika, why don't you recap for our listeners visionary and kick us off and set the scene
Yeah.
for us?
Well, first of all, I have to say, Donna, I'm so thrilled to have you on the podcast and really, really excited about this trial and the results that you presented and are going to share with our audience. As many of our listeners may know, the Visionary trial was the largest IgA nephropathy trial to date with 510 patients. It's a phase three global clinical trial, and it compared sibeprenlimab to placebo in patients with high-risk IgA nephropathy. We're going to hear more about this from Donna. You all may recall that the proteinuria results were presented by Dr. Vlado Perkovic at the European Renal Association meeting, which we covered earlier this year. But of course, we've been waiting for the GFR results, which are at the end of the 2-year clinical trial, and we're so thrilled to have you, Donna, to share those results with us. So thank you again for being here, and maybe you could start by just kind of recapping for us what the study design of Visionary looked like and what type of patients were enrolled, and maybe how this trial design might have been slightly different from some of the other phase three trials in IgAN.
Yeah, thanks, Shika. And Brendan, thank you for having me. So, as you mentioned, Shika, the Visionary trial was a phase three trial. It's a global study that enrolled patients with biopsy-proven IgA nephropathy, really from all around the world. So, very good representation. Patients made it into the trial if they had, again, a biopsy that showed IgA nephropathy, primary IgA nephropathy. They had to have a GFR over 30. And it might be worth mentioning that if their GFR was between 30 and 44, they had to have a biopsy within 3 years. If it was over 45, so pretty good preserved GFR, they could have had a biopsy at any point in time. And then they had to have significant proteinuria. So as you mentioned, these are high-risk patients that had either more than a gram a day of protein or more than 0.75 gram per gram, again, based on a 24-hour collection. Once they made it past the screening, they were all well treated. So they were on maximum tolerated RAS inhibition. They were also allowed to be on SGLT2 inhibitors. That dose had to be stable again for 3 months. And they, of course, could not be on concomitant immunosuppressive medications leading up to the study. So once they made it past the screening, they were then randomized to receive sibeprenlimab, 400 milligrams subcutaneously every 4 weeks, or placebo. And it might be worth reminding the audience that sibeprenlimab is a anti-APRIL therapy. And maybe we can explain what APRIL does, and is that okay? So APRIL is a cytokine that is important in allowing B cells to become IgA secreting cells, and also is important for the survival of B cells. And as As we know, IgA nephropathy is an immune-mediated disease. It's been summarized by the four-hit hypothesis, but essentially there is an overproduction or increased levels of galactose-deficient IgA1, against which you start forming autoantibodies. Then circulating immune complexes form that ultimately deposit in the kidneys and cause inflammation and then ultimately fibrosis. So targeting B cells and this immune backbone to the disease is of course important, makes sense, and that was the premise for the anti-APRIL therapy at this time.
Thanks, Donna. Yeah, and I think, this class of drugs is really something new in our field, right? So compared to the other therapies we've had for IgA nephropathy, I think there's been particular excitement around these sort of B cell modulators. And from conversations I know we've had, there had been quite a bit of, preclinical data leading up to this and GWAS data that sort of gave us a hint that APRIL was an important player in the pathogenesis of IgA nephropathy, but how exciting now to be at the point where we actually have a therapy that can block APRIL, and we've been able to now see it both in, the phase two ENVISION trial and the phase three VISIONARY trial, and with some pretty exciting results.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, translational science at its best. We had genetic data, basic science data, animal data, and then ultimately human data that again seems to be panning out. Absolutely.
So you're absolutely right, Dana, that the basic and translational science was particularly compelling. But what was so exciting about Visionary, I think, for many people was the earlier phase data that suggested preservation of GFR may be possible. But these data were really limited to short-term follow-up. Can you recap for us from Visionary what types of patients were recruited? Perhaps the interim proteinuria data from 9 months, which was previously presented, and of course the GFR data long term that you reported in Maui.
Thank you, Brendan, for reminding us about the phase two studies. Again, the signals were quite exciting, and so we were all waiting for the phase three trial. So, when we presented the data, we presented the entire baseline characteristics of the cohort, remembering that the previous presentations included the cohort that was involved in the interim analysis, the one that looked at the proteinuria results at 9 months. We looked at the 510 patients that were included in the trial. Nothing had, significantly changed. On average, patients were in their 40s. There was a slight predominance of male, patients, which is common for the disease itself. There was great representation of different racial groups, again, reflective of the global nature of the trial. On average, the eGFR at the time of study entry was fairly well preserved. The mean was about 63 to 65 milliliters per minute. Patients had a proteinuria of about 1.3 to 1.5 grams per day. So again, high-risk patients, as we discussed. About 80% of patients had hematuria at baseline. So if you're a hematuria, enthusiast, a lot of them did have hematuria. And the vast majority, about 98%, were on RAS inhibition, as you would expect from a well-treated population. And about 45% were on SGLT2 inhibitors. And again, reflective of, the changing landscape of treatment in these trial populations. So you see the uptake in the use of SGLT2 inhibitor as newer trials are, releasing their data. So with that, we reviewed, first of all, the proteinuria data. At 9 months, there was a relative reduction of about 51% in the sibeprenlimab group compared to placebo. And that's important to remind people because that was the premise for the FDA to grant sibeprenlimab accelerated approval. Which made it available, at least for Shika and I, to prescribe in the United States to our patients. So that was exciting. And we kind of knew when you have significant proteinuria reduction that that should translate into GFR preservation or at least improvement in kidney outcomes. And so that's what we were waiting for at the 2 years. So In this presentation, we released the two major secondary outcomes. So the key secondary outcome was the GFR slope at the annualized slope between the sibeprenlimab group and the placebo group. And it was remarkable to see that the patients that received placebo lost about 4.2 milliliters per minute per year, whereas the patients who received sibeprenlimab had almost complete flattening of the slope and of about 0.3 milliliter per minute per year. So for a difference between the two arms of 4.5 milliliters per minute per year. The other thing we looked at is the change in eGFR at the end of 2 years. So the placebo group lost about 7.9 milliliters per minute at the end of the 2 years compared to their baseline, whereas the mean eGFR change in the sibeprenlimab group was completely flat, 1.3 milliliters, if anything, a little bit positive at the end of 2 years. So the difference between the two groups was quite remarkable, 9.2 milliliter per minute eGFR difference at the end of 2 years, which is massive. And the KDIGO guidelines in 2025 had set the bar so high to try to reach, to allow patients to get to a GFR loss of less than 1 milliliter per minute per year, which essentially meant that we would have to restore physiologic kidney function loss, which I don't know about you and Shika, but I thought, where in the world are we going to be able to achieve that? So it was quite impressive to see that it is potentially feasible, at least within the 2 year time frame that we looked at, that we would achieve such a lofty goal.
Donna, first of all, congratulations to you and the entire Visionary team. I mean, this is absolutely remarkable. As you said, I think the bar was set high by the 2025 KDIGO guidelines. A lot of people recognize that the trials to date are slowing GFR decline compared to placebo, but nowhere near really flattening that curve. And this is really the first trial to show that this is possible within a 2 year setting. So I think, incredible, incredible times for patients with IgA nephropathy, and huge kudos to you and the rest of the team for making this possible. One of the things, Donna, that I think comes up, and I know this is some data that you presented, is, were the people that were really achieving the goal, were they more likely to be patients who started off at higher GFRs? Were they patients who started off at lower grade proteinuria, so a little bit easier to get to what we would call remission, and then therefore maybe had a better chance of hitting the outcome? What about whether they were on SGLT2 or not? Do you have some of that subgroup analysis data that you could mention?
Yeah, great question. So we had three pre-specified subgroups to look at. One, the first one was around proteinuria, as you mentioned, people that had either high proteinuria, 2 grams per day or more, or less than 2 gram. The second subgroup were people that had relatively low eGFR, so between 30 and 45 or 45 and above. And the third group, SGLT2 inhibitor, yes or no. And in all of these subgroups, the results were pretty consistent. They, of course, favored the sibeprenlimab arm. And across all subgroups, we saw the same benefit, which is, again, speaks to how solid these results were. We did not see any difference in any of these specific subgroups.
The SGLT2 inhibitor subgroup is really, really reassuring as well in my view, Dana. It suggests that there's a role for combining these agents for kidney preservation long term. At least as important as the safety data, and one of the theoretical concerns with B cell modulating agents has always been infection, but you also presented the safety data from Visionary. Can you walk us through the adverse event data and, in particular, perhaps highlight the infection data as well, because those were quite compelling.
Yes, so anytime we're modulating the immune system, we of course have to make sure that patients are safe, especially that We're talking about long-term treatment. So we looked at this safety data again in the entire cohort at 2 years, and the adverse events were quite similar between the two arms. About 90% of patients reported some sort of adverse event. When we looked at treatment-related adverse events, those were about 35%, and interestingly, they were similar in the two arms, placebo and sibeprenlimab. Serious adverse events were equally distributed, if anything, slightly higher in the placebo group. And the leading cause for serious adverse events was infection, as expected. But, infections were reported in about 2% in the sibeprenlimab group and about 4% in the placebo group. So really, relatively small numbers. Serious treatment-related adverse events, severe treatment-emergent adverse event, any type of adverse event we looked at, we really didn't see any safety signal that would be concerning for the sibeprenlimab group. Again, within the context of the 2-year data that we have. And importantly, there was no death. And patients who discontinued drug because of an adverse event were in the single digits, so about 1% or so in the sibeprenlimab group. So fairly well tolerated, very good safety data, very reassuring. Again, these are new classes of drugs, so to see, good safety data is very important. Especially, we're using them in IgA nephropathy now, but I can imagine that these would be drugs used in multiple glomerular diseases in the future. And so, it's very reassuring to see that.
This is, I think, really reassuring as we think about, how we're going to treat these patients going forward. And I think one of the other questions that comes up is, what happens to immunoglobulin levels? And maybe, Donna, you could comment on, was there a cutoff of IgG levels for patients that were enrolled in this trial?
So they did have, I think their IgG level had to be over 600 at study entry. We did track immunoglobulin levels, all three immunoglobulin levels, A, G, and M. That data will be reported soon. We did not have it in time for the GlomCon presentation, but as importantly, to look at adverse events in the context of low immunoglobulin levels, if any. And so we will share that data pretty soon, because to your point, it is important, again, as we modulate these B cells to keep an eye on the immunoglobulin levels.
Absolutely. And I mean, as we think about monitoring these patients and the real world, and we have these conversations at meetings, when do we need to be concerned? And is there a time point that we might need to hold drug, or if they're not having infections, can we continue? I think those are the sorts of real world things that nephrologists are going to grapple with now that the drug's available in some parts of the world and hopefully will become available in other parts of the world soon. One of the other things, Donna, that I was wondering, so I know you may not have this data yet, but have you guys looked at, or are you planning on looking at subgroups of UPCR less than 2 grams? So we know that patients in this trial entered at, say, 0.75 grams per gram, I believe, or greater than 1 gram per day on a 24-hour urine collection. Is that something you guys will be looking at in the patients who, were at lower grades of proteinuria and how they might compare?
Absolutely. I think we need to slice and dice this data the best we can, and all these kind of post hoc analyses would be helpful again for clinicians to give them guidance. We, would want to look at people that achieve also proteinuria outcomes set forth by the guidelines. We talked about the eGFR high bar, but they set also a very high proteinuria bar to try to get people to less than 0.5 gram per day or less than 0.3 if we can, which again, not many people can get to that level. And what would that mean in the future in the context of a stable eGFR? I mean, I don't know. I know Brendan challenged me to that question when we were in Maui, and it is hard to believe that residual proteinuria would not have any impact. I mean, I'm still a little bit nervous leaving people proteinuric even if their eGFR is stable. I think we'll need longer term data, and some of it will come from the open label extension. hopefully, but yeah, more to come. I mean, the more we learn about IgA, the more we, have to
More
dig
questions.
further and answer more questions. But the practical questions about guidance to what do we monitor? What do you check before starting these therapies? I mean, these are very important questions that will, I think, emerge from real-world data. We won't be able to answer everything through clinical trials, but hopefully we'll have, national or global efforts to put data together to look at these things and help clinicians make decisions. Absolutely.
Since I already asked Dana the question in Hawaii, I'm going to turn the spotlight on to you, Shika, and see what you think.
Oh, geez.
Oh,
You
good.
know, go ahead.
Goody,
I already, well, go ahead and ask, and then let me see
goody. Yes.
if Donna and I have the same answer.
I mean, one of the signs of a great clinical trial or a paradigm shifting clinical trial is that it raises additional questions that are completely unexpected. And Dana alluded to this, but if you reduce proteinuria by 50% and you're going from a median of 1.3, that means on average the median residual proteinuria is still more than 0.5 gram a day. But you're getting complete stabilization of kidney function altogether. So, Shika, what do you think about that residual proteinuria? Is it just related to glomerulosclerosis? Everything is it still important as a treatment target? What are your views? Do you think we just need longer term follow-up? I mean, these are unanswerable questions, so there are no wrong answers at the moment. What do you
No,
think?
it's so important for us to think about this, and I think one of the challenges, and we didn't get into this yet, but we all know there's no good biomarker in IgA nephropathy, right? So we know that all the trials are measuring Gd-IgA1 levels, and we see Gd-IgA1 levels going down with many of these therapies, and total IgA levels going down as well. And it seems like that tracks with reduction in proteinuria, not always with GFR stabilization. So that's something new, I think, with this class of drugs. And we see that when you stop the drug, proteinuria goes up, Gd-IgA1 levels start to rise. And I think we're not quite at the place yet where we can, have an activity marker of disease. And some people, Donna alluded to this, are hematuria enthusiasts. Unfortunately, in a clinical trial, we just don't have the ability to really get good data related to hematuria because of the way it's collected and all of those things. And then, again, keeping in mind what Donna said about biopsies, these are not patients with incident biopsies. Now, some of them did have a biopsy within 3 years if their GFR was on the lower end, but some of these people may have been biopsied 2, 3, 4 years out. So again, what value does that MESC score have in terms of giving us further sort of direction? In terms of your question, though, about residual proteinuria, I think that we have to separate, if someone has a gram or 2 grams of proteinuria versus someone that has 0.5 gram of residual proteinuria. To me, those are sort of different things. And I also think we need to think about the question of, well, would we start an immunomodulatory therapy when someone's at 0.5, 0.7? Are we comfortable doing that? Or would we want them to have quite a bit higher proteinuria, greater than a gram, gram and a half, before we would do immunomodulatory therapy? And like you said, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. But that being said, with a 50% reduction, if I were to get a patient down from 1.5 grams to 0.75, or from 1 gram to 0.5, am I comfortable knowing that their GFR is stable? And I would say I'm not 100% comfortable with residual proteinuria. And here's why. It's not that I'm suggesting that we layer on more immunomodulatory therapy. I'm not. But I'm gonna put on my want to be cardiologist hat here. And I'm going to, and I see you smiling because I know this is your space, Brendan. I think cardiologists would look at 500 milligrams of proteinuria or albuminuria and be like, oh my God, I can't believe you're not doing anything about that. And so I really think that while GFR may be stable, we really need to think about what kills our patients. And what kills our patients predominantly is cardiovascular disease. So I really think that We need to drive proteinuria as low as possible. I would not ignore residual proteinuria specifically because of cardiovascular risk reduction. Just like we're thinking about, the four pillars in diabetic kidney disease, I don't think we should ignore glomerular disease and think that just because we hit a flat GFR, we should allow them to sit at, some gr degree of proteinuria that we wouldn't otherwise allow in other forms of CKD. So I think we do need more data. I would be really interested in, sort of dissecting out what that residual proteinuria is. And maybe as we get more mechanistic studies, we're going to get some of those answers. But right now, man, this is fantastic that we can stabilize GFR. I can't wait to see some of the additional data that's going to be presented so we can really see how many of these patients are getting into complete remission, and how many of them have some residual proteinuria left. Because as you mentioned, there's already patients in this trial on SGLT2 inhibitors. So is there a significant amount of residual proteinuria? Is there room for, other additions? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the Achilles heel of proteinuria, which has been a fantastic biomarker, don't get me wrong, but it cannot distinguish ongoing active, immunologically active lesions versus I have scarring and therefore I'm still leaking protein. Both have not turned out to be good for kidneys in the long run, at least, from IgA and other diseases. And for IgA in particular, the time frame is so long for some of these young patients that you really are playing the long game, the very long game, 10,
Yes.
15,
Yes.
20, 30 years. And so we will not get these answers again from clinical trials potentially, but from, real world data and leaning on everything we know about the epidemiology of the disease. So for now, I think all three are in agreement, believe it or not, that residual proteinuria may not be something to ignore. So we'll see, more to come. But there
Yeah.
are, as you mentioned, Chika, a couple of trials, mechanistic trials, so biopsies at study entry and after treatment with sibeprenlimab, but other agents as well. And these are going to be very important to help us maybe identify histological features that would then help us decide that patient gets drug A or B. And really understand at the tissue level what are these drugs doing. There are boatloads of biomarker data still to come, not just again from this trial and others. And then the long-term open label extensions are very important from safety perspective and again sustainability of these results. So I think we're scratching the surface, but exciting time and very happy for IgA patients, most importantly.
So maybe I'm going to ask Donna one more question because she's an expert in Gd-IgA1 and assays. Donna, do you think that, these biomarkers are going to be able to help us differentiate activity versus, as you said, proteinuria that's from scar? Or do you think we're going to need a panel of biomarkers? And where do you see us going forward with the Gd-IgA1?
I mean, that's an awesome question. So I think, first of all, Gd-IgA1 we know is a good prognostic biomarker. So above and beyond GFR and proteinuria, at least, in smaller studies, it has been shown to risk stratify patients. So I think that may be important to know. And then down the line, for all these trials that have collected and biobanked samples, it'll be important to see, does the Gd-IgA1 reduction, is there a threshold, first of all, below which, because we all have Gd-IgA1, so we may not have to get rid of it completely, but is there a threshold below which people, seem to do really well? Or is there a percent reduction that maybe if you go below a certain threshold, the body can get rid of immune complexes? I mean, we're geared, our body is geared to get rid of immune complexes. Maybe if we just reduce the amount enough, and does it track with relapses? We don't know any of these answers. So for now, it's been aggregate data reduction in, Gd-IgA1 on the order of 65% or so, We don't have the 2-year data for this particular trial, but at least, from the phase two study, it showed the same thing. So we owe our patients better answers, and these biomarkers cannot be tested except in these very large, study populations. So I hope that we get some of these answers, and look at all sorts of biomarkers, because I think we may end up needing a panel of biomarkers and maybe also test for the autoantibody or the immune complexes. So we did show at GlomCon as well that sibeprenlimab reduces the circulating immune complexes, and that correlates with the reduction in total IgA, total IgG, and Gd-IgA1 as well. So the data is building up. I think we've been spoiled by the PLA2R antibody biomarker. It's this perfect biomarker for everything: diagnosis, prognosis, response to treatment, relapse, transplant recurrence. I mean, it is an unbelievable biomarker, but it is a very, very unusual and exceptional biomarker. So for most other diseases, you need different biomarkers for different questions or a panel of biomarkers. And I think that's where we're going with IgA. But we need to, push people that have big biobanks to look at these questions and answer them.
Absolutely agree with
Absolutely,
you.
Dana. A long way to go, but very exciting. And you've hinted at the potential immunological effects of these drugs, which may be applicable beyond IgA to other glomerular diseases. Where do you see this field heading in terms of who might benefit from a B cell therapy and where we should go next in testing these agents?
I think any honestly disease where you can you think there is an autoimmune component, antibody formation, so on and so forth, might benefit. Where we're seeing people trying to apply not necessarily sibeprenlimab, but B cell modulators in general, atacicept, povetacicept, so on and so forth, are diseases like membranous nephropathy, sometimes lupus nephritis. And then staying close to IgA nephropathy, we need to test these drugs in pediatric patients, where I think the response would be phenomenal, because most patients that get biopsied as children typically don't have much sclerosis, and you're dealing with a hot inflammatory lesion. So maybe these would be the patients who don't even need supportive care, where you go straight to the immunologic therapy. I don't know. We have to make sure they're safe in children, of course, because that's a whole other population. IgA vasculitis. There's even some interest in ANCA vasculitis to look at these therapies. So it is really, I mean, their applicability is quite large. And honestly, if we understand the disease pathogenesis, you can then start thinking, does the Do B cells play a significant role in that particular disease? And if the answer is yes, then they may be worth trying. I have already gotten questions about, which I rarely answer, like to all the listeners, it is not personal. I rarely answer medical questions on Twitter or anything else. But I did get questions about post-transplant recurrence and whether we should give somebody an anti-APRIL agent, again, just because we have the data that we just presented. And if so, what do we do with the other immunologic agents that are, on board and needed to prevent rejection? These are unanswered but amazing questions. And just to be able to sit here and say, we can do all these things, we can test all these, potential applications, is remarkable. I mean, we've come a long, long way in the last 10 years.
No, it's kind of incredible, to think back to the fact that we only used to give our patients corticosteroids if they had greater than a gram per day of proteinuria after 3 to 6 months of, RAS inhibition and lifestyle changes, and how the pendulum has swung now completely in a different direction. And we are, I hope, much more, aggressive and having less treatment inertia in terms of identifying these patients and getting early treatment. Although the whole question of, screening and ensuring that patients get to nephrologists and get biopsied is a whole separate issue that we'll maybe have to touch on another time. But I think, Donna, this is really just an incredible time for patients with IgA nephropathy who, a decade ago really didn't have much hope and had to deal with significant steroid side effects if they tried anything at all. And many patients chose not to. And now we finally have something that not only is going to reduce proteinuria, but stabilize GFR at least over 2 years and hopefully much longer. And it sounds like is really, really well tolerated, and a once a month injection, which is, very different from, say, taking a injection every day or a pill every day. So I'm thrilled for our patients and for the work that you all did in bringing this trial to completion.
I mean, the trials are take a big village. So I have to thank all the patients that participated, their families that support them through that whole process, every site, every research coordinator, site PI. I mean, it takes unbelievable effort, especially for a global trial to pull together and to have, people stick through. I mean, this is a trial that, go 2 years of follow-up means 4 to 5 year trial, and to have people adhere and kind of stick around and bear through the entire process is amazing. So many people to thank. I'm privileged to be part of this story. So again, just to live through it is an honor, to be honest.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. It really does feel like we live in a different world now after last week, and the preservation of GFR that we observed in Visionary. And congratulations again on the fantastic results, the presentation, all the work that all the Visionary investigators and of course the patients who contributed to the trial. And I suspect this is probably not the last time you'll appear on Kidney Compass, and we look forward to having you on to explore many of the unanswered questions which you've raised today, and hopefully get reliable and robust answers to those questions for our patients in the future.
I look forward to it. Thank you for having me. It's been really a pleasure. Good to see you.
Well, I just want to echo, we love having you on the podcast, Donna, and look forward to many more conversations about IgA nephropathy and how we're going to use these therapies and our patients as more data comes out. And we'll look forward to connecting with you again, hopefully at another major meeting soon. And with that, I think we will go ahead and conclude this episode of Kidney Compass. And look forward to speaking with you all and stay tuned for further episodes and follow us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, etc.